I'm James Fadiman, and I teach part-time at this Institute for Transpersonal Psychology. I was a co-founder, but through a number of artful dodges, I have demoted myself a number of times over the years. So I'm now an adjunct teacher, and I do a number of other things in this world. For me, transpersonal psychology is the fact that we are interested in all of human experience. And conventional psychology, if you think of a normal bell curve of anything, normal psychology or conventional psychology tends to look at from the middle on down into the psychopathology and weirdness and mental illness part. Now, the other half of the normal bell curve, from normal to superior to exceptional, to dazzling, to the people who change whole cultures, which turn out to be a combination of heroes, saints, visionaries. I'm just as interested in that. So for me, transpersonal is the human condition, specifically. You know, the most interesting area being the part in which personality is not seen as the outer limit of the human being. Transpersonal psychology is an attempt to use all of human experience. And the scientific method is a way of looking and testing and observing. And unless it's misused and turned into scientism, a kind of religious fanaticism about numbers, it's a wonderful way of exploring human beings and the world. Traditional psychology is a limited subset of that, not as scientific as it pretends to be, but also interested in mainly the way normal people are and the way people who fall off the table from normal are. Transpersonal is a blend of that as well. And in terms of what mysticism is about, most mysticism is about the wisdom that comes back from the mystical event. It's kind of the traveler goes into the higher realms of consciousness and brings back the goods, be that the Quran or the Ten Commandments. I'm just as interested in what kind of a person can do that, and what was it in their background that allowed them to transcend the conventional wisdom? I mean, this isn't people thinking out of the box. This is people who are thinking out of their own time frame, their own culture, their own linguistic limitations. And so the blend, the reason that we're such a sophisticated psychology is that we start by taking in a few thousand years of other people's good work. And most of the spiritual traditions are actually, if you look carefully, are psychological traditions about how can you function in a difficult situation called being a human being on this planet. See, from our point of view, if you look at regular psychology, we're clearly should be the kind of capstone, because we are including more. We're not denying anything within psychology. We're obviously least interested in small animals with tails that eat cheese. So if we look at all of psychology, we're interested in almost all of it. And we simply are saying every culture known to humanity has been interested in the physical, the emotional, the intellectual, and the spiritual. For psychology to say, we're kind of interested in the physical, we kind of call it sports psychology, and it's a new thing, but we're kind of into it. And emotional things, that's called psychotherapy, and it's basically dealing with deficit issues and abuse and problems and social justice. And that's okay. And we're interested in everything intellectual, because that's what universities basically are designed to do very well. And the spiritual, Don't want to talk about it. Don't bring it up. Don't mention it at dinner. Don't ask people what their tradition is or what their church they go to, because that's going to be difficult. And we think that's silly. When people say, what's transpersonal therapy? And I say, it's therapy, which includes all these things. And they say, well, what's the difference? And I say, well, if you go to, imagine going to a therapist, and the therapist says, you can talk about anything you want, as long as it's intellectual. And you think, this is really some very sick dude. And you say, well, no thanks. And they go back to another therapist, and he says, you can talk about anything that's intellectual and emotional, but nothing sexual. And you think, oh, I've hit a Victorian who, they didn't have sex. They never knew quite how it happened. But I have sexual feelings, and everyone I know has sexual feelings, so any therapist who won't talk about sexual feelings is missing a lot of my experience. And therefore, kind of like the three little pigs here, you then go to the house of brick, and the therapist, and you go to the therapist and says, well, of course you can talk about sexual feelings, and you may even have sexual feelings toward me, and we can talk about that. And of course, we'll deal with your emotional life and with your childhood. And of course, your ideas are very important, but nothing spiritual, because I don't deal with that. And you say, wait a moment, I'm not doing it. I'm not going to be with you either. Because that's the same nuttiness of denying a major part of human experience. And if you say to that therapist, name me a culture on earth, except perhaps for psychotherapists, who don't deal with spiritual issues on a daily basis, and I'll be very excited and I'll go study them. And he says, well, there's people over in the university. But when they go home, they have spiritual lives too. So I guess that's not it. I guess this is the only place where we don't discuss the spiritual. And since I've just said, I'm a psychotherapist here to help you lead your life, I'm not really going to do a very good job unless I include that. So the educational model, when you put it immediately into any kind of pragmatic other areas such as psychotherapy, immediately becomes obvious. See, we're the ultimate conservatives. We're doing what everybody's always done as long as people have talked to each other and helped each other. And conventional psychology, which came both out of certain experimental scientific base and then as it was a very young discipline, it looked around as a child would and saw who are the popular kids. If you look around a university, who are the popular kids? Who gets the money? Who gets the new cars? Who gets the tenured chairs? Who gets the better buildings? It ain't medieval French. It's science. So psychology said, I'm a science. And we came along and said, if you're a science, that means you got to be interested in everything that's observed. You can't be a half a science. And most conventional psychology said, if you knew how hard it was to get admitted to the club with the popular kids, you would not ask me to let go of that and hang out with the people in the rattiest building on campus where they teach the history of religion. So in a way, one can be totally understanding and compassionate of conventional psychology because they're doing the best they can given a wrong career choice, which is they hung out with the wrong kids. And since nobody, in a sense, invited us in, we formed our own little club. The difference is that people were welcome in our little club if they wanted to be, and still are. Remember that bell curve of normal and so forth. Now, psychology used to only be from normal down. Now there's a whole new word called positive psychology, which is normal up. But they don't go very far up. Nobody is saying, well, is St. Teresa a good role model in psychology? They're saying maybe Hillary Clinton. Powerful, strong, attractive, interesting women, and so forth and so on. But when we get into the people who transcend, traditional psychology still would rather we go away. So psychology is growing at that part, but we are still not welcome at the table. But at least the table itself has gotten bigger. Well, transpersonal psychology actually arose out of the living room of Anthony Sutich, who lived in Palo Alto, California. And Anthony Sutich, a very unsung hero, actually founded two out of the four major forms of psychology in the world. And Tony, as he was known, was a remarkable man who was paralyzed from arthritis at around age 18 and made a living, a full living, being a psychotherapist. But he was very interested in kind of what was good about people, what was decent, what was kind, what was compassionate. And he became friends with Abe Maslow, who was studying kind of the positive side of human beings. And humanistic psychology came out of that initial relationship. But it was, while Abe was well-known, president of the APA, major books, etc., Tony actually ran the journal, the association, and kind of the place in which people could talk to one another. And at some point in Tony's development, I appeared. And so one day a week, I volunteered to help Tony, as many people of wonderful people did. So I became part of the journal staff and part of the scene. And then we became, Tony realized we really had to go on. He had to give up this incredible thing that he'd built because it was too small. We kind of hit the glass ceiling, which was there was clearly something beyond the personal being, beyond the personality, beyond the Jim Fadiman-ness of me, there was something more. And perhaps because Tony had only one arm and part of his face muscles that worked, he was more attuned to that than most of us would have been, because he was not, his body was not something that was he was overly attached to. And so we began to explore what this other would be. And we initially had terrible terms like transhumanistic, which always to me felt like son of Lassie. And so we eventually came up with this notion of transpersonal. Tony wrote to all our distinguished editors on the journal and said, I'm going on, do you want to join me? And half of them wrote back and said, I don't quite know where you're going, but sign me up. And the other half basically wrote that, I don't know quite where you're going, but I already don't like it. Because it sounds like you are going out of, in a sense, the atheistic world of humanistic psychology into the world in which there are religious issues and religious traditions. And so we basically said goodbye to them, and off we went. Now there are, I think, 18 international transpersonal associations, meaning the Transpersonal Association of Germany and of Norway and of Finland and of Japan, several of which are, I think, larger than the association in the United States. So that was a little bit of how we started. And we started because we wanted to know what was it that was beyond personal identity. And the early definitions were very flexible. Every issue of the journal had a slightly different definition of what transpersonal is, which is why it's kind of the insider's joke to define transpersonal, because you're allowed to define it along the lines that interest you, as long as it contains this kind of core element of more than the personality. In our beginnings, we were, after all, in the midst of the 60s ferment. And one of the things that was in that ferment was that every institution was being looked at to see whether it was successful in what it said it was out to do. I used to walk around Stanford, where I was employed in the counseling, and I would say, imagine if this were an educational institution. Look at the facilities. What we could do with this. And people would look at me funny, and then I would get to explain that the education was so partial. I mean, not partial, impartial. It was just a very limited subset of what educational experience was. So here was that. where education was clearly being seen as limited, universities were being shut down by political activists, rather than the universities saying, we should include social activism as part of the curriculum if that's what everyone is interested in. Again, the feminist revolution, and people were discovering that their religious traditions, in many cases, had dried up. That they were not getting the experience of being closer to their divine inner nature by going through the church, mosque, synagogue that they'd been brought up in. So they were trying to find new models. Or, when they were a little more serious as students, finding out within their own tradition there were models available that had either been kind of tossed out or suppressed. That was the ferment. And then sprinkled over that were psychedelic drugs. And psychedelic drugs gave people, if they gave them nothing else, an experience that said the particular cognitive structures that they had thought were defining the world were defining a subset of the world. At the same time, as another part of the ferment, the translations of major Eastern texts were beginning to appear. So that the idea of a bookstore that specialized in non-Western thought was again a wonderful novelty, and all of a sudden had a lot of people wanting to buy whatever was available. So you had the kind of Eastern sophisticated practices and the beginning of teachers. You had the kind of psychedelic breakdown of the conventional order. You had also birth control. For the first time in the history of humanity, women had something to say about their own pregnancy. And this was now before we had learned that birth control pills had long-term negative effects. They had short-term, extraordinarily positive effects as far as women were concerned, which is they could be as free sexually as they wished and as safe sexually as they wished, rather than dependent on men. You add that in, where you have very casual and easy sexual happening. You have very easy ways to have profound mystical experiences. You have the breakdown of the kind of disapproval of conventional institutions. And in the background, you have a war that was ultimately seen to be extraordinarily inappropriate and unjust. So that was the ferment in which psychology found itself. And we were at, kind of if you imagine the bubbles coming off of this stew, we were riding the bubbles. We were not outlaws, but we were not, the center of the culture was the least interesting place to go. And none of us were very interested in being there. How did the field get created? In a sense, it was created as one of the experiments, just as communes where, you know, you worked nude until you all got too sunburned and blistered, or as one wonderful young man was telling me about a commune in Santa Cruz that had broken up, and I say, why did it break up? And he thought, and he said, well, everybody had slept with everybody, and then we went home. So there were a lot of experiments going on. We were the experiments within the psychological framework. So the way the school was invented, and Bob has spoken of this, is we had not the faintest intention of setting up a school. But we did think about what a real education would have been like had we been able to go to an education, a place of genuinely, in that case, higher or at least high education. And between us, we invented a model that was simply what people who don't want to write a textbook do to amuse themselves. And then we put it out in a little newsletter, and people wrote in and said, where's the school? And that was really Bob's problem from that point on. I was very happy to help. Well, we are the place in the world where people assume the ideas are emerging. So we're really the fountainhead. And I've spent a lot of time with both the Japanese transpersonal and a lot of the European transpersonal people, being invited to conferences, helping set things up, and so forth. And the feeling is that they look to us for what is the direction of the field, because we're the only institution solely devoted to transpersonal. We have no other agenda, and therefore our students have not much more agendas. Their publications and their workshops are what is moving the field. So, and our faculty tend to be more and more pulled in from having had an education, usually within a major spiritual tradition and a conventional psychological tradition. So then that's our function, is we are the non-proselytizing active center of it all, because we in no way make much of an effort to reach out to all these other parts of the world. So we don't treat ourselves as the international center that we actually are in everyone's minds. And what I've said is we are extraordinarily well-known worldwide. We are less well-known in the United States. We are less well-known in California. And in Palo Alto, we are not well-known at all. This is not to our credit. The original model of transpersonal education, as Bob and Jim would have it, and since no one else was doing it, we were allowed to be the inventors, was an education that was equally interested in one's emotional learning, one's physical learning, that the body actually mattered, intellectual learning, which is what we all conventionally know as graduate education, and the fourth component was to be of service, which translates as if what you're learning isn't useful to anyone else, perhaps we shouldn't be pushing you in that direction. There's one contribution that most people don't know to the world of philosophy is called pragmatism. It was a philosophical movement. We all just think that's the way things are, and Americans are pragmatic and practical. Well, we actually took it seriously and said, as that fourth component, are you of any use? And our theory was that if you were trained at the level of emotional maturity so that you might be a gifted therapist, if you were trained at the level of physical capacity so that you could be a black belt in a martial art or be a therapist in a physical discipline such as Feldenkrais work or yoga, or, and I'm just thinking of things our graduates have done, and intellectually that you could be the equivalent in terms of being able to teach, research, publish, think, and talk to someone from, you know, Stanford or Dartmouth or Brown. And you had this awareness that you were more than your personality, and that one of the things that was necessary for you to do was to see if you could be of service to someone, which might have meant being an educational researcher in an arcane area. This was not about social justice. It was about being useful, being valued because you had high-level skills, emotional, physical, and intellectual. And so that was the model. And that's very attractive. And having come from places where it's not unfair to say that most psychology departments basically say you are allowed to work with your whole body from the eyebrows up, and that don't talk about the rest of it. And so that's obviously, and the way I'm putting it, is a very silly model. However, in the conventional academic world, the body is really divided up between departments. As at one point in my design engineering world, we put in a course on how to be a college professor, meaning how to teach. Here we're turning out, you know, all these people with great research skills who are going to make their living actually teaching. And one of the things that happened as soon as we offered a course on how to be a good college teacher, the education department rushed over and tried to shut us down. And we said, all these lovely design engineers that I was with, we said, are you teaching it? And they said, no. And we said, one of those seven words that you can't say on radio or television, off. Because it seemed to us, you know, that's, so that's the same model in a sense we have here, is what do you want out of your life? And you want to have a full being. You don't want to neglect some major part of you. It's like, it's as if we said, well, we're only teaching people's right arms. And you say, well, that's really dumb. And we'd say, well, but we know how to teach right arms, and we've got a department of right arms. And we'd say, but I want to be the whole person. You say, well, you can do that on your own, but we want to use most of your day and most of your evenings, and we want you to take a couple of years to do a whole thing about right arms. So the students who came here began to realize fairly quickly on that if they wanted a easy, cushy, easy, simple education, go to Harvard, go to Stanford. If you wanted to really be stretched in ways that you couldn't imagine, you would give yourself permission to be stretched if you came here. So we're a terribly difficult place to be because we are asking people to reevaluate in all those areas. Transpersonal psychology really is, and we've thought about talking about it this way, it's world psychology. It's not American psychology. American psychology is pragmatism, scientific method, animal research, quantitative analysis. The major contribution of American psychology has been called cognitive or behavioral. So if you go to Europe, I was in Portugal a couple of years ago, invited by students, not by faculty. And the faculty at the University of Portugal was divided between the Freudians, who thought the behaviorists were trash, and the behaviorists, who knew the Freudians were trash. That's extreme, but that's very often what you see in psychology departments around the world. We started by realizing that the kinds of things we were interested in had only been explored in any depth within the spiritual traditions, so that we all found Buddhism initially intellectually so rich and so well developed and described so accurately the various areas of consciousness that interested us. So there was a lack for a number of years of really looking within the Christian tradition, and it's less visible in the Christian tradition, but again, explorers of consciousness have been there and mapped the same territory. We saw it in the Greek Eleusinian mysteries. We certainly saw it in a lot of the Kabbalah work, which was much of it coming out of the 12th and 13th century. In Europe, actually, is when the Kabbalah became kind of more developed. Certainly Hasidic Judaism was a form of ecstatic Judaism, which was much more in touch with the kinds of experiences we were studying. So what we found is that transpersonal was sucking in an enormous amount of Eastern understanding of how personality was, and that we were seeing, again, in Hinduism, both in the physical practices which were designed, yoga is designed to allow energy to pass through the body without harming the body. That's the fundamental value that yoga was created for. It was not created so that you would get more flexible knees and be able to sit in funny postures. It was created so that the energy which can move up and down the spine, causing intense altered states of consciousness, could be done without harming the body. And then there were all the multiple gods or mythological energies described in Hindu mythology, which made sense to us in terms of what we were personally experiencing. So we were, as I've said earlier, we were explorers, and we would come, but unlike Columbus, we didn't come to this land and nobody was there to help us. We would land in Zen, and suddenly we were surrounded by people who said, oh, you finally made it. Have anything you want to know, I probably know. And they did. So we would come back with these great big treasure barrels of wisdom, and people would say, is this psychology? And we'd say, uh-huh. But it isn't like anything I ever studied in my psychology. We'd say, uh-huh. And they'd say, well, where'd you get it? And we'd say, well, there are these other traditions where people have been studying how do you manage on the planet as a human being. And the stuff that's worked sifts out. So you have to look at if something's been working for 1,000 years, probably it's pretty good. Or at least it's worth checking. And so we were instantly incredibly naive and very, very sophisticated. There's a lot of, oh, the Eastern people have done this for so long and they are so smart and they, therefore, we should study under them. One of the things we learn, being psychologists, is we know a lot about childhood. And most Eastern traditions have no interest in it. And if you ask a guru, just an Indian guru, what was your childhood like? I'll tell you, any guru would give me, I'll give you the same answer. Oh, it was very good. It was fine. And you should honor your mother and your father. Anything happened in childhood? No. Come on, what happened in childhood? Now we will breed together and we will approach bliss together. And what's your problem, buddy? What is this bringing up of childhood that I have not thought about in decades? So we have actually a very sophisticated observation of the effects of childhood on adulthood, maybe excessive. They have an incredibly sophisticated view of what do you do when you're really trying to train your mind. So we see transpersonal psychology not as a meeting of East and West, not as a blending of East and West, but as a constant interaction of what's working in each of these multiple systems, so that for most of our work is in the West, and so the blend is seen more as it's useful for Westerners. But the Japanese Transpersonal Association runs the blend a little differently and is an enormously popular and powerful growing influence in Japanese psychotherapy and psychology and education. My own involvement in psychedelics predates most of the culture's involvement, because as an undergraduate at Harvard, I had worked with a very bright, very charming, very neurotic young professor named Richard Alpert. And Richard Alpert brought me out to Stanford on a summer research project along with a very, very bright graduate student named Ralph Metzner. And so we did research. And I didn't know anything, and so I was the kind of gopher of the group and knew the least, but I was a bright kid. And so we became friends. And actually, on my way back to Harvard, I had a car accident, and Dick Alpert really was incredibly helpful in making sure I could do my senior year, and so forth and so on. So we were genuinely the way it is with a good professor and a good student, that kind of mentor relationship. And then I finished, went off, and was living in France. And he came over to do a speech with Aldous Huxley and Tim Leary at an international psychological something or other in Copenhagen. And it was the first time they were going to talk about psychedelics, which had happened in the year I was away. So Dick Alpert met me in Paris, you know, his ex-student, and he said, the most wonderful thing in the world has happened to me. And I want to share it with you. And I looked at this man, who I knew fairly well, and one of the things that you get from a Harvard education is an unbelievably undeserved arrogance about everything. And so I looked at him with my usual arrogance and saw that instead of the highly neurotic, bright, interesting man I knew, was a much healthier guy. Just energetically, and I didn't use the term then because I didn't know what it meant, he felt better, he sounded better, he seemed better, he was easier to be with, and I thought, hey man, I don't know what you're talking about, but it sure looks good. And then he reached into his pocket and came out with this little vial of something, and I thought, what is he talking about? I didn't drink coffee. And if I had a beer, it was only to prove that I was overage. And here he was offering me a pill, and I thought, I don't know about this, but the evidence is good. So we sat in a cafe, and he gave me a couple of pills of psilocybin, what we would now call a moderately low dose, and we're sitting there, and the colors are getting brighter, and the noise is getting crisper, and I'm hearing things, you know, I'm hearing more stuff, more sensory input, and it's getting very intense. And I say to him, now this is his first trip to Paris, and I say to him, this is really just too much for me. He says, it's too much for me, and I'm not taking anything. I'm just a tourist. And so we went back to my little walk-up hotel room, and for the next few hours, I found that as I relaxed into this experience, that a lot of my theories of what was necessary for me to be who I was were limited. And that a level of human interaction and closeness, kind of vibing good buddies, emerged at a level that was inconceivable to me 5 hours earlier. And I also went through a great personal revelation, which is, if you took away my books, I would not die. Because when you come out of a Harvard education, it's fairly clear that you probably would die without your books. And a week later, he was off to Copenhagen. And a couple of days after that, I followed him and said, I don't know what we did, but I didn't quite get all of it. And so we did it again. And in those days, the model with psilocybin is both people would take it at the same time. So we had another experience, which was, again, very moving for me, and I went off and continued to live my life, and eventually ended up getting a letter from my draft board saying, would you like to join us in Vietnam and see a lot of interesting places, but probably on your knees and elbows carrying an M1? Or have you considered that you were accepted to graduate school last year but held it off? And I said, as much as I like living in Paris and writing fiction and doing very interesting things, I'm suddenly excited by graduate school. And so I ended up at Stanford, which felt to me like a very, very nice prison compared to the life I had. And that the psychology department seemed devoid of anything that now filled my consciousness, which is, what on earth was I experiencing? What was that about? Had anyone else ever done it in history? The feeling of true exploration is a remarkable one. We get it very rarely in our lives. Little children who move from toddler to walking and the whole view changes, it's about that level. So I went to a museum in Amsterdam and was looking at Impressionists, and I'd go around and say, that one knew, and that one didn't. And I knew I was right. Now, in retrospect, I would hesitate. But I think I started with this kind of propensity to arrogance, and psychedelics didn't lower it. So I hit graduate school, and psychology was really dull and uninteresting and constricting and boring. And I thought, if I did not have this other option of being drafted, I would leave. But being drafted was a kind of like a little hand waving in the background saying, we're ready if you are. And there was one person at Stanford named Willis Harmon. And Willis Harmon was teaching what was called a graduate special outside the system on the human potential. And in that class, you were to look at various areas of literature and science and philosophy and religion and look at what could we say about the human potential. And I went into his office and he said, oh, I'm sorry, my course is full, but maybe next quarter. And I looked at him and with a burst of intuition, I said, I've had psilocybin 3 times. And he got up, walked across his office, which looked exactly like the office of an associate professor of electrical engineering should look like. There wasn't anything in it that wasn't, you know, dull and full of mathematical symbols. Closed the door and said, let's talk. So we taught that course that quarter because he knew I was willing to talk about my psychedelic experiences and he wasn't about to blow his cover. And so I thought to myself, I have nothing to lose except that they'll throw me out of the university and I'll get killed. But other than that, I had nothing to lose. And so I very, very delicately worked my way through my graduate career, staying, in a sense, one step ahead of them catching me for being a far-out freak. And one of the ways I did it, for example, is I was the only graduate student in the psychology department that always showed up in a jacket and tie, because everyone else wore what you would wear in California. But I thought, these professors, since they have no idea what's going on inside my head, if I look straight, they'll assume I'm straight. And they did. And so I would do psychology by day, and at night I would be desperately giving myself an education, and reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and reading Jung, and reading Alan Watts, and making contact with the tiny bit, the few researchers, really, in those days that existed. So that's how I got into it, is through this professorial friend, and then at Stanford, really a research model, because in before the government decided that learning is inherently bad for you, there were what was called investigational drug licensed. And LSD was the most researched drug in the world. And I had from Sandoz, when I was still in my second year of graduate school, a huge book of the first 1,000 research studies using this material. So this was the most researched drug, not in the world, but in psychiatry. And it was very exciting all over the world. And I was part of this early research team with a group called the International Foundation for Advanced Study in Menlo Park. LSD is a powerful mind-opening drug that, depending entirely on set and setting, or what we might call expectation and the situation, will take you beyond your own personal limits in those directions. So if you take it in a situation of danger, you will be into a state of such terror as cannot be imagined. If you take it in a loving state, you will be in a kind of communication of bliss as you've never imagined. It is not at all a drug that's useful for being sexual, because the identification with the body really is secondary. So it doesn't, it is wonderful for communion in a safe enough space, but it is not a kind of an emotion, like ecstasy is much more a hanging out with people just emotionally drug, and it doesn't take you to many, many other places. LSD is actually, my best definition is, there's a character in literature called Baron Munchausen, and Baron Munchausen, among other things, at one point gets on his horse and rides off in all directions. For me, LSD is an all-direction experience. And it depends very much on the set and setting in which directions it'll go. My own training was to maximize its therapeutic value, but you maximize its therapeutic value by helping people transcend their personal identity and have a transcendental, spiritual, religious, mystic, whatever one calls it, experience, and have enough of a vocabulary about that world from prior experience so that when one returns, one carries with one some idea that this makes sense. The usual experience that someone in a good LSD session would say is, I was more real than I have ever been in my life, and that this world, while it is real, is not as real as the world I entered into. So is it a spiritual experience? Is the answer is sometimes, under the right conditions. But under the right conditions, it almost always is. Out of the people who were then using psychedelics, which included now many, many people, one of the revolutions that doesn't give psychedelics its full credit is called the computer revolution. And if you went to the first hackers conference, now these are the people who are really the very brightest people, both many of them starting companies or have started companies, but they're the people who just love to play with this stuff. And you say to them, how many of you were fundamentally influenced to go into this part of the computer world through your own personal psychedelic experience, it was about 80%. But it was also agreed that this was not the group that wanted to mention that to the general world. So, in a sense, one of the offshoots has been the transpersonal movement, again, started by a number of people who were very comfortable with the experiences historically only associated with highly developed yogis and mystics. And that was one of the very strange things, is those of us with no preparation or background, but also no preconceived form, were experiencing these things. And therefore, we were explorers. We were not scientists. We were explorers, and we would get in our little boat, and it would go somewhere, and then we would try desperately to figure out where we were, and eventually our boat would go back and deposit us back here, and we would go talk to other both explorers and people who were curious about explorers. So if there was a National Geographic of the Mind, we were the guys you see on the cover, you know, with the big photo jackets and taking 82 rolls of films and living in the, you know, with the beekeepers of Nepal for a year. So this exploration led to what could we do that would make the culture work better? And that led to the educational model that led to the transpersonal graduate school and really to the transpersonal movement. Now, not everyone in early transpersonal was involved with psychedelics. I was, Stan Grof was, certain other people were, but many people weren't. If one looks at the results of 30, 35 years of psychedelic research, most of it unpublished, most of it illegal, but done all over the world, and information fundamentally shared, is that it and 100 other, well, I'm thinking psilocybin, a mushroom, there's 100 species of psilocybin. It's widely available all over the earth. LSD occurs naturally in nature, in certain, in morning glory seeds, for example. Several kinds, oddly enough, called heavenly blue and pearly gates, and I still wonder who named them and what did he know. And so what we're finding, these are naturally occurring substances. They're found in, a substance is found in pufferfish. There are various things in South American jungles. And then we begin to see that cultures all over the world have discovered them and used them. So that our excitement at a molecule out of Sandoz Pharmaceuticals in Basel, Switzerland, turned out to be cultural ignorance as much as anything else. So what we found is that the capacity to transcend conventional reality is available widely and has been used in every culture in which it has been available. So that we are one of the few cultures that has ever taken the position, on the one hand, that you shouldn't have spiritual experience, and on the other hand, we're one of the few cultures that has said, let us take this material, this plant, which has been used historically only for spiritual purposes, and let's use it recreationally. So we're also the first culture that said, let's turn on groove, lie in the grass, and swing. And the confusion in that is one of the results. So we are a culture which really doesn't know which way this is supposed to go. The spiritual has been banned and hidden. The recreational has been banned, and as any banned substance is widely available. I mean, one of the great parodies of the war on drugs is, I know if I go to any city in the United States, there's one place where I know drugs are totally available, and that's the prison. So one of the results we've learned is any culture that has access to ways to change their consciousness in ways that many people find either pleasurable, beneficial, or insightful, will do so. And we really didn't know that at the beginning. I mean, it sounds silly and obvious, but at the beginning, what we knew is we were discovering a new world. It's kind of like Columbus came over and discovered a new world, and all the Indians said to each other, what's new? Doesn't look new to us. We've been here, you know, as long as our people have history. So this is not a new world. You're just the new kid on the block. So those of us who were so excited and formed the transpersonal and so forth is we just come out of this little teeny enclave called American science that had been the only place in history we'd ever found that didn't use these materials already. Another part of the work that I've done is how to make people's lives work better, which seemed to me a nice thing to do. And I have been a therapist. I am not a licensed therapist, but I worked at Stanford as a counselor. And it was not very interesting. I was not very good. And my students all improved because when your clientele is on the whole well-to-do, very smart, very ambitious, young, healthy people, they don't really like being nuts for very long. They don't get a lot out of it. There's no secondary gain. So they were more than willing to improve. But I found that having worked in psychedelic therapy, where people would make massive personality changes that they would integrate all by themselves, psychotherapy wasn't the place. So I ended up with someone who'd come to observe our research, a man named John Boyle, who taught a course in which he was teaching people that their intention or their attitude or their ideas or literally what they would say to themselves mattered enormously in whether their life worked or not. And that people would talk themselves into either failure or success. Success, emotional, physical, financial, and so forth. And the way the seminars, as he packaged them, were hustled were predominantly that one of the really easy things we'll do for you is raise your income. And that turned out to be relatively easy. And so what I did is I became an instructor in this stuff and would work with people who had fortunately no psychedelic experience, most of them no psychotherapy experience, no New Age experience. These were people who made canisters to put chemicals in that would be shipped to the Far East, or who did, you know, real estate development in Atlanta. So this was very much Middle America or equivalent, but relatively successful people. And we insisted that if they came to this seminar to make their lives work, that they had to bring their spouse, which was novel at that time, because we knew that while promising them money might bring them in, that they would quickly learn that if they actually could have what they wanted, that money was to buy things with, was to buy health, was to make relationships work. So we said, well, let's skip the money part, and we'll also give you tools to make your relationships better, your kids do better in school and like you more, and all the things that really matter. You know, as they say, when you're on your deathbed, you don't say, I wish I'd spent more time at the office. So we were dealing with all the non-office things. And what I learned is that the universe is made of relatively soft stuff, and that thought is relatively hard stuff, and that if you hold a thought and the image is like a diamond, it's hard stuff. And when you push a diamond into the pudding of the world, the pudding forms around the shape of the diamond. So that literally the people who establish goals, do practices that maintain those goals in their mind, various things which are relatively well known in lots of parts of the culture now. It's in the New Testament, it's in a lot of self-help courses, it's in a lot of sales courses, but we really had, I think, a rather finely tuned version of it. That their lives will work because they will hold on to the diamond and the world will conform around them because the world doesn't care. I mean, here is a method that really works. Now, where in psychology should one find this? Well, one should find it because this is pure psychology. And it's beneficial. It's non, you know, it's politically correct. Everybody can use it. It's not about education because I've taught it to, like, little children. And I've taught it to people who are close to death. But no psychology department in the United States teaches this material. Because for some reason, it doesn't meet whatever the paradigm is in conventional psychology. And that's among the reasons that we're still doing what we're doing. because the need to communicate some of the most successful and easiest ways to make this world better are what we call transpersonal issues. We are widely popular in the general culture. We are not widely popular in the academic culture because, again, if you have decided that the spiritual has no part in the university or in the academic world, then it's really hard for you to bring it in. If I go and talk with 100 physicists, I can talk to them very easily about spiritual issues because they all are human beings. Now, if we say, let's only meet in the physics building, it's going to be harder. I was at a hospital once, and I was talking about multiple personality. And I got in the elevator, and the title was something about goal setting for my talk. And I looked, I said, wait a moment. She said, don't worry. There's a whole group in the hospital that's frightened of multiple personality stuff. So we all know what you're going to talk about, but we put that up just to cover, okay? So we frighten people whose world is designed without a spiritual component, just as Freud frightened people whose life was designed without a sexual component. But if you start from the position that there is a spiritual world and that most Americans think there is, here is a psychology that's trying to make some sense of that. That's where I'd start.